You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Wesley Morris, a film critic for the Boston Globe, wrote recently that he wishes Philip Lopate's new anthology, American Movie Critics, had been available when he was studying film theory in college. The book is published by the Library of America and brings my novelist, essayist, and film critic brother Philip back to my show today. Hello.
Lovely to be here.
The word you seem to prefer is movies and not film, not cinema. Why not just use them interchangeably, like everyone else?
I do use them interchangeably. I don't have any greater allegiance to movie or film. I think it's silly when people say that film is snobbish or the cinema is pretentious. I do use them interchangeably, but one of them had to be on the cover of the book. Otherwise, we would have had a lot of slashes.
Well, you do. The reason I asked is because you're making a case for film criticism to be seen as a branch of American letters in the Belles Lettres tradition, and that usually suggests film or cinema.
Yes, yes. Well, as I say, this is a non-issue, Lenny.
Okay. Well, a number of your viewers have expressed some regret that you haven't included some of your own film criticism here.
Yes.
And you haven't done it simply because you have other books out of your own, or because that would have been immodest?
I ran out of space. The book is very long. Library of America gave me a generous amount of pages, about 750 pages. But I would have needed another 200 pages to include just about everybody. And since I couldn't include a lot of people who were on the cusp, myself included, you know, I said, well, I wrote the introduction. I wrote the head notes. I picked the contents. Maybe that's enough for me.
Do you think that you got into writing film criticism the way many of the other people here have, or is each one of these critics a unique story?
I think most of us are movie mad, and we go to a movie, and we have a lot of thoughts about it, and we keep having this conversation in our heads. And we want to talk to other people about it. And if we're writers, we start writing about movies. I keep meeting young people, 18, 19, 20, who ask me how they can get into movie criticism because they're obsessed with films. They're thinking about it. Some of them go on the internet, have blogs or things like that. But it all comes out of wanting to respond when you're passionate about something.
But I think it takes a certain mindset, doesn't it? I reviewed a college production of a play when I was a freshman, and I panned it. Mm-hmm. And then I had to face the actors and the playwright, who was one of the teachers at the school throughout the rest of that term. And that was the last review I ever wrote.
Yes. Well, it raises the whole question about, you know, which is more fun to read, pans or praises, you know.
Well, I just mean it, telling people that I think that this was good or this was bad became something that made me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And other people seem to enjoy doing that. I'm perfectly happy to talk about it after I've seen the movie, but putting it on paper, that takes a special kind of mindset, I think.
Well, you have to have a store of critical judgment and maybe even a little bit of anger.
Mm-hmm. You've also written screenplays. Did all those years of thinking about movies when you were writing reviews help or hinder when you were then trying to write your own?
They didn't help that much. I wasn't a very good screenwriter because I'd already established my own voice as a novelist and an essayist and poet, and it was hard for me to eat the amount of crow that was necessary to be a good screenwriter.
On the other hand, there have been any number of film critics who've written films.
That's right.
James Agee is included in this book, Paul Schrader, and then most of the French New Wave film directors were all critics.
Jonas Mekas also was a filmmaker, Père Lawrence, who they're both in the book. Yeah, exactly. Obviously, for the French, it was a way to launch them into filmmaking, and Paul Schrader was an excellent film critic. And then he went on to make movies that he himself says are not exactly the movies that he admires.
So why do you think that is? On the other hand, you might like James Agee's scripts better than you like some of his film reviews.
I like his film reviews.
You seem to be ambivalent.
I like some of them. I mean, I think that A.G. had a very Baroque, complicated Mandarin prose style, and he sat on a very high horse, and he was always looking for the movie that didn't exist yet, you know, the movie that was in his dreams, and that's one of the reasons why he went on to make movies, because he really was very passionate about film, and he wanted to see films that had real-life locations, that had non-actors, that were deeply engaged in social issues, that had a kind of semi-documentary feel. And so, of course, he welcomed the tie-in neorealist films. And he, as you know, contributed to The Quiet One and In the Street, as well as African Queen. But I think part of what my ambivalence about James Agee stems from is that he didn't always review the film that was. He reviewed the film that he imagined and that he wanted there to be. And he tried to will a kind of film into existence. So he was a visionary in a way.
I want to go back to something you said earlier. You said you have to eat a certain amount of crow to be a screenwriter.
Yeah.
That's because it always gets changed?
Because it always gets changed because very often producers or directors or stars don't know what they want, but they know what they don't want. So you keep feeding them different dishes, and they say, no, take that back.
It's almost like writing for James Agee, I think. Philip Lopate is here. His latest book is an anthology of film criticism from the silence until now called American Movie Critics, and it's published as part of the Library of America series of American literature. You begin the anthology with the poet Vachel Lindsay. Was he the first real movie reviewer?
Well, there were earlier movie reviewers in the daily newspapers. A lot of them were, to put it bluntly, shills for the industry. I think that Lindsay was the first important film reviewer, and he believed in movies as an art form. And so he was writing against a certain skepticism, because a lot of people just thought that movies were one step above burlesque and Nickelodeon. And he saw potential. He loved Griffith, obviously. He loved Intolerance, especially. Loved Douglas Fairbanks. And he tried to tell people that movies were had a lot of elements in them that overlapped with other art forms, like painting and sculpture, tried to kind of upgrade the image of movies.
Didn't that debate actually continue maybe even into today?
Yes,
some people
it does.
Who think that movies are just not as high art as other art forms?
Yeah, some people will still say, well, movies are not an art form. I think that movies are both art and entertainment. Some movies are the equal of any of the greatest art that was made in the 20th century and continues to be made in the 21st century. Obviously, a ton of movies are made without any ambition of being artistic. They're just made to while away the time.
But because films had to invent a whole new way of telling a story, doesn't that automatically make them into an art form? I mean, there are good paintings and bad paintings.
Yes,
there are
yes.
good There are poets and bad poets, and there are good movies and bad movies.
Yeah, they're a medium. Is radio an art form? You tell me.
No, well, we are not, but everything else
that's
is.
That's an interesting question. You know, for film critics, it put them on the spot because they couldn't very well review every movie as a kind of failed piece of art, as though every movie were attempting to be Citizen Kane, because most movies didn't start out with that intention, and they couldn't act excruciatingly disappointed because not every film was the equal of Chekhov or Matisse.
Well, I'd imagine that with all these film studies programs that we have in our colleges,
yes,
that more recent reviewers have not been involved in that debate. Because they've already studied it, in fact, in connection to the most sophisticated philosophical ideas.
Well, I also think that there's more of an awareness now of what's been called the genius of the system. That is, that the filmmaker may not be a great artist, but if you have very good technicians, if you have very good producers, if you have very good actors, you can produce a seamless product. That's a beautiful, smooth, elegant almost a piece of machinery, you know?
This book is being called the first to define the tradition of movie reviewing. If that's true, why do you think it's taken over a century of movie history for something like this to have been done?
It's interesting. I quote Otis Ferguson, who was one of the first great American movie critics, saying, why isn't there a school of American film criticism, since obviously American movies were so important? I do think it took a while for that school to gel. There were previous anthologies, but one of the best that was edited by Stanley Kaufman stopped at Citizen Kane. Another useful one edited by David Denby was really a much more slender book. So I saw that nothing like this existed, and I wanted to combine my two great loves, which were essays and movies, and see if I could do this anthology. I really would have been happy if someone else had done it, but it didn't exist, so I realized I had to be the one to do it.
And you've included people like Otis Ferguson, who is a revelation to many readers today.
Yes.
Was he considered important in his time?
For those in the know, he was considered important. But he was writing for the New Republic, so he wasn't writing for a publication that had a lot of movie ads. Therefore, he could say whatever he wanted, but he wasn't taken as seriously by the industry, for instance. What was great about Otis Ferguson, lots of things were great about Otis Ferguson. He was a jazz fan, and his style of writing had a real jazzy syncopated quality that kept bubbling along. And then he wasn't dour and disapproving. He really understood. He was really the first to get how Hollywood put it all together and how there could be a beautiful film without necessarily a lot of artistic pretension.
You talked about putting these two things together, the essay form and your interest in film criticism, and you have any number of people who are known as essayists rather than as film critics or film reviewers. Mm. What's the difference in the way they look at films?
Well, that's a really good question, Lenny. In between the professional film critics who I put in, like, you know, Andrew Saras and Pauline Kael and Manny Farber and so on.
Manny Farber, who quit reviewing to become a painter, didn't he?
He was a painter all along, and he was one of the best movie critics, and after a while he hung it up. Actually, he started writing movie reviews with his wife, the painter Patricia Patterson. And even now he says that he thinks about writing film criticism. He's still writing in his head, but he's not writing down on paper.
Okay, so these are the professional film critics.
Right. And then I wanted to assert this case that in America, movies not only drew the professional critics, but drew a lot of wonderful writers who we think of as some of the exemplars of the best of American critical prose into movie reviewing. So that included people like Edmund Wilson, James Baldwin, the poets H.D., John Ashbery. So many important writers took a crack at movie criticism. It was in the air, and they responded. And when they wrote beautifully and intelligently, I wanted to include some of that.
Philip Lopate is here. His latest book is an anthology he has edited, From the Silence Until Now, for the Library of America. It's called American Movie Critics, and we will continue after this. We're back with Philip Lopate. His latest book is one of the ones he's edited. It's called American Movie Critics, an anthology from the silence until now, published by the Library of America. What do you think is most important for a critic to be able to do when approaching a film, or is there not just one way? Is it a matter of capturing something visual into words, or is it talking about the ideas of a film?
I think what I'm looking for is for the critic to think on the page in an interesting way. And so that certainly they have to be able to render visual experience crisply and economically. They have to figure out a line of attack, because films are so complicated that you can't just eat your way like a tapeworm scene by scene through a film. You have to kind of figure out a way to get into it quickly. They have to be, it seems to me, fair-minded. That is, not, you know, not settling scores, you know, trying to understand at least what the filmmaker was trying to do.
Many of the critics in the golden age of Hollywood films mm-hmm. reviewed movies as though they were works of literature and often missed what was really good about them.
Well, it's a question because, you know, you and I, Lenny, came to our love of films in the age of, let's say, formalist film criticism, where we were taught to look at movies, to read them visually, to look at the composition, the lighting, the cutting, mise-en-scène, all those things. And we were taught to downgrade the themes, let's say. But in fact, you can't separate the sociology or the literature from the visual, the essence of film, you know. And I agree with John Simon when he says films are, you know, blessedly both a medium of pictures and a medium of words. Words are equally important.
But this is where the great debates occurred in the 50s and 60s, I guess, where some critics said it was that writers had been downplayed, their role had been downplayed, mm-hmm. and the director's role had been given just too much importance.
Yes.
And that debate continues to this day. In fact, we've seen any number of complaints about what happened during the recent Oscars.
Exactly. Well, you know, films are a collaborative art, and it's very hard sometimes to establish who is the real author of a film, who's the most important figure. As a job description, the director is supposed to be, but the director isn't always. Otis Ferguson wrote about people like Jimmy Cagney and Mae West and the Marx Brothers who, you know, were dominant presences in their films more than the directors, let's say.
Have reviewers become less relevant to the culture today? I remember a time when people would discuss a review that they'd read or argue the relative merits of the Pauline Kael, Andrew Sarris debates, but no more. I have a feeling that since Siskel and Ebert, most people just, if they even read a review or watch one on television, it's simply to find out what they're going to go see the next time they go to the movies.
Well, there's always going to be that consumer guide function of the critic. But the pleasure of reading film criticism goes way beyond the consumer guide, the thumbs up or thumbs down. And in fact, I think Roger Ebert is a pretty good film critic.
You included him in this?
I include him here. Day in, day out, he writes clean, intelligent, thoughtful prose. He's a real professional. I admire anyone who can do this, you know, day in, day out. You know, to ask me whether film criticism matters less than it used to, when here I am trying to sell copies of my book of movie criticism is really putting me on the spot. Lenny, I thought this was going to be an easy interview, you know. You're my brother here, you know. But I think that people still look to film critics if they start out with some predisposition, you know. Like, I don't think I really want to go to that film. And then they read a critic that they respect, and the critic says, it's really not very good. And they say, well, that does it. Or vice versa. They're inclined to go and the critic pushes it. Now, you develop a relationship with your favorite film critics. You discover after a while that they have certain blindnesses. They have certain hot spots, you know. And just as with a friend, you learn to kind of tune out certain shrill registers, you know, and to compensate for obsessions or blind spots, you know. So I think that you know, the best description I've come across was Stanley Cavell's when he said that what he looks for in a film critic is a missing companion. And so I feel the same way. I regard film critics who I trust as friends. And when I say I trust them, I don't mean I always agree with them. I mean I trust them to be true to their vision, their character.
But has it worked another way? Have you had a negative or a positive response to a film and then read a really insightful review?
Yes.
And had your mind changed?
Yes. To give you an example, and here's one that I know we share somewhat. I was not thrilled with Eyes Wide Shut, the Stanley Kubrick movie. And in fact, I may say that I have something of a blind spot about Stanley Kubrick. He's never completely wowed me. But I've read criticism of Kubrick. And in fact, I put an essay in here by Jonathan Rosenbaum about Eyes Wide Shut. And I think it's very intelligently argued. And made me think that maybe it is a very good movie, but one that I can't appreciate.
Which can happen in all art.
Exactly.
There are writers, some of the greatest
painters,
writers that ever lived.
Of course, yeah.
So that, well, what happens when you're sitting on the selection committee for the New York Film Festival?
Yes.
Do you have to keep that in mind as well? Well, maybe this is my response, but other people might find this film to be more interesting or important.
We should explain that I am on the on a five-member selection committee for the New York Film Festival, and so I watch hundreds of films a year. And the New York Film Festival is an odd film festival in that it selects the creme de la creme. It's only 25 films. So we really have to curate what we regard as the best films that are out there at the moment of the film festival. And I feel pretty confident about saying this is an important film or that one is not. When I write a film review, I have to. It's a much more complicated process, you know, and I do have to consider what the intentions of the film were.
My guest is Philip Lopate, and the latest book, I can't say the latest book he's written, although there's a very long introduction by Philip in it, is American Movie Critics, an anthology from The Silence Until Now. It is published by the Library of America. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Can you define each era of American history by what the role of its films were thought to be?
What do you mean exactly?
Well, initially, films were viewed as an escapist drug, you know, and then it became very seriously thought of during World War II, for example.
You know, that's interesting.
Worthy of studies on human psychology.
During World War II, there started to be the growth of what I would call the sociological school. And you had probably the most famous example of this was Siegfried Krakauer's book, which was From Caligari to Hitler. And you also had Hortense Powdermaker's Hollywood, The Dream Factory, and a book by Wolfenstein and Leides, a book by Barbara Deming, even though hers actually appeared later. They were all looking at national character through the lens of film. And I remember when I was a teenager first falling in love with movies, I thought all of this was ridiculous. But because I was sort of entranced with the visual look of a movie, you know, if you gave me a 360-degree tracking shot, I was yours forever, you know. But it's interesting that
and there are so many now.
Now, you see what happened is they became diluted. So, I mean, if you look at someone like Andrew Saris, at one point he would poke fun at those people like Hortense Powdermaker and Krakauer. And then he began to be much more interested in politics and even wrote a book called Politics in the Cinema. And someone like Jay Hoberman, who's also in the book, at one point was much more of a formalist critic, and now he's much more interested in the intersection between sociology, national character, and formalism.
Well, there is a problem with certain films. For example, Birth of a Nation.
Yes, exactly.
Gone with the Wind, another one.
You can't just look at Birth of a Nation as what pretty compositions, you know. Because you've got Ku Klux Klan is riding around. Yeah, exactly.
You have a lot of what we might consider hateful politics today. On the other hand, you have a piece here by Melvin Tolson.
Yes.
Gone with the Wind is more dangerous than Birth of a Nation.
Yeah, Melvin Tolson was a fascinating black poet who also had a column in a black newspaper at the time and wrote a lot of movie reviews. It was a real film buff. And he was horrified by Gone with the Wind and by the whole sympathy for the Southern losing cause and said, you know, why not only why are whites going for this, but why are blacks going for this, you know? So he couldn't help but talk about that. And I also have an essay by Ralph Ellison in here, and James Baldwin, who really wrote hundreds of pages of film criticism. He wrote a whole book about movies. So he was almost like in between an amateur and a professional film critic. But they all were looking at race, obviously. You can't not.
That becomes a problem for the daily critics, because it's one thing when it's Ellison or Baldwin or Bell Hooks, who you've also included here, but when it's someone like Armand White or Elvis Mitchell, who's reviewing films on a regular basis, race cannot be the focus of every review.
Although I put Armand White in, and I think he's a very two-fisted film critic who just wades in there, you know, with his opinions. And I purposely put in two of his reviews of Spike Lee films. The first one, Do the Right Thing, he really liked. The second one, Malcolm X, he hated. So as I say, you can't divorce form from content in this. And what I'm really looking at for, what I was trying to put forward, is lively and elegant and interesting writing.
Dwight MacDonald had five questions that he would ask to measure every film against.
Yes.
That would be very limiting, wouldn't it?
Well, he wanted to think about was the character portrayal realistic, and what were the five questions, by the way? I know I quoted him.
I don't know. I thought Passover is coming up,
but guess. But what was interesting, oh yes, he says, are the characters consistent, and in fact, are the characters at all? Is it true to life is the second question. Third, is the photography cliché, or is it adapted to the particular film and therefore original? Four, do the parts go together? Do they add up to something? Is there a rhythm established, that there is form, shape, climax, building up tension and exploding it? Five, is there a mind behind it? Is there a feeling that a single intelligence has imposed its own view on the material? These are intelligent questions, actually, but
there's a problem of imposing realism on
characters,
and some great films are purposely stylized.
Yes, he came to realize after a while that they were proceeding from a too narrowly realistic mindset, and he scrapped all five questions and came up with one question, which is, if I saw it again, would I still be moved? Because he realized he'd been such an enthusiast for so many things that didn't last, you know. And that's a whole other question, which is, do you go back to films? Do you revisit them? You see a film at 20, you see it at 40. Is it the same film? This is part of the Andrew Saras, Pauline Kael debate, because Andrew Saras so often would revisit a film and change his mind about it or qualify his original position. I purposely put in the book his denigration of Billy Wilder, and then years later his confession or admission that he had underestimated Wilder. Pauline Kael famously said that she only saw movies once, even though obviously it wasn't always true.
In some cases, if you look at a publication and its history, you see this kind of change. For example, the New York Times for years wasn't respected by people who were serious about movies when Bazzi Crowther was the reviewer mostly. And then they got very serious.
Yeah, now that's funny because you and I, Lenny, grew up shaking our fist at the New York Times and screaming at Bazzi Crowther every morning. The funny thing is that when I was preparing this book, I read a lot of Bazzi Crowther, and I realized that, you know, he was a pretty good literary stylist. I didn't put him in the book, but I was tempted to. He was, when we were growing up, the enemy. He had a review of Bonnie and Clyde that essentially got him fired. He said, this is a bunch of junk. Why are we glorifying these bandits, you know? And the film doesn't hold together. And Pauline Kael wrote famously a very long defense of Bonnie and Clyde. And I think the Times decided that they had to get rid of fuddy-duddy Bosley.
Well, earlier he had written a review of Godard's Contempt, which, by the way, will be screened next Monday at an event that you're part of. I'll tell everyone more about that. He wrote he didn't know why the hero was spending so much time worrying about whether his wife, played by Brigitte Bardot, liked him or not. He said he should have just thrown him over his knees and given her a good spanking.
Yes.
And that didn't get him fired from the New York Times.
No.
So, which also reveals something else about it, where America has come.
Bossy Crowther was like the tired businessman as movie critic, you know. What are they trying to put over on me now? That kind of thing. You might say, in a way, the opposite of Manola Dargis, who's reviewing now and who I did include in the book. Manola Dargis really knows an awful lot about film history, avant-garde film, international film, obscure film, and she's an advocate. She's not the tired businesswoman, you know. She's really trying to raise the level of film consciousness, and I give her a lot of credit.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, will you stay here and answer some calls from our listeners?
I believe I will.
Our number is 212-433-9692. Here's your chance to weigh in on film criticism.